And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Paul Rowland, and this is a special public affairs program here on KBOO. And we're going to be talking about, as you heard, the Willamette Falls history, what's going on, and maybe what we can expect in the future, if we can expect anything in the future. And we've got several guests. We have on the line with us David Lewis. Are you there, David?
I am here.
Good morning. And David, as you heard, is a member of the Grand Ronde Tribe, a tribal historian, a curator of their museum, and relatively recently, last year, I believe, elected chairman of the Oregon Heritage Commission. And we have Roxandra Pennington. And good morning, Roxanne.
Good morning, Paul.
I guess your voice will be fairly easy to distinguish. It's several levels higher than the rest of ours. And so you're at the Museum of the Oregon Territories.
Exactly, Museum of the Oregon Territory. It's the Clackamas County Historical Society Museum.
And we'll talk about that. Yeah. I just want to introduce everybody. And we've got Spider Moccasin, as you heard, a Warm Spring Tribal member, longtime Portland area musician, and many times appeared on KBOO Radio. Morning, Spider.
Well, howdy. Good morning, everybody. I'm joined here by my guitarist, Jimmy Haskett, the amazing talent from Theater of Sheep, the highly influential Theater of Sheep. Can you believe it? I can't believe he's in the same room with me, and he's holding an instrument.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much for that, Spider. So to get started, I was just going to ask each of you to go around and let us know a little bit about yourselves, where you come from, what you've been doing with your lives up to this point briefly. And let's start with you, David. Just tell us a little bit about your trajectory, how you got to the positions you're in right now.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, I've been working. I was a student at the University of Oregon for about 16 years, and was taking anthropology and other courses there for many years. And eventually, in 2009, I received a PhD in anthropology. That was fully supported by the Grand Ronde Tribe. And then, in the meantime, in 2006, I applied for the cultural manager position at the Grand Ronde Tribe and received and got that job. And so, working sort of in a parallel job track, I was doing my dissertation and working under culture at Grand Ronde and helping sort of direct the culture there. And so I've been working in the culture department for 7 years now, and right now my current position is a curator and tribal historian, and I will be hopefully elevating to the position of museum director here in a few months. So we're building a museum at Grand Ronde, and so we've been putting all of the programs in place to get that museum going. But I'm basically a native of this place, of Western Oregon. My heritage is Chinook, Saniam Kalapuya, and Tequelma, and so I come from throughout Western Oregon, and all of our peoples are at the Grand Ronde Tribe.
Yeah, I got to tell you this, that I was hanging out at the University of Oregon a couple years ago when I first got back to Oregon after many years away, and I was in the library, and I came across your book about the termination of the Grand Ronde, a very, very extensively researched and comprehensive book. I was really impressed. It just made me feel really good that there's, you know, a new generation of people out there taking on, telling the story of the Native people and what happened. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And let's go to Roxandra, who has something in common with David as being involved in museum work. Tell us how you got to where you are.
Well, thanks. I started, I guess, as a naturalist and an outdoor school instructor, and worked a lot with wild animal rehabilitation, moved into science writing, and eventually became a director for the American Visionary Art Museum. Worked for various museums of industrial history, including OMSI, and finally had the opportunity to become the only full-time employee for a unique museum poised right at Willamette Falls. And that museum's gone through radical change in the past 2-3 years as volunteers from PSU have come in, reorganized the exhibits, and we have decided what story we're capable of telling and have begun to tell that story on a larger scale than ever. And this is definitely our largest event.
Yeah, we haven't actually, we're going to talk about that, but just briefly, the reason we're having this program is because there is an event tomorrow in Oregon City at Willamette Falls called Willamette Falls, Where the Future Began, and we'll have plenty of opportunity for you to explain all about what's going on, and Spider Moccasin's going to be there, and some members of the Grand Ronde are going to be there, so that's what we're talking about. And so... Jimmy, would you like to just say a couple words about your involvement in...
I'm really admired by the talent that Spider Moccasin has, and it's a privilege to be associated with him and his cause, and he's just he's a great guy, and he's a very talented musician, and I'm just really, really blessed to be a part of whatever he does.
Well, wow. Then that leads right to you, Spider.
Good,
get a little closer to the mic.
Good grief. How do you follow that? Good gravy.
Give it a shot.
You know, my real name is Marcus Mosley, and I'm an enrolled member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, Oregon. I'm a Wasco Warm Springs Indian, and I perform contemporary modern tribal folk songs about social and environmental justice issues. And through the years, I've tended to work with veterans from the Portland underground music scene that thrived around the old Satyricon. And so, you know, I've been lucky enough to play with members of Hell Cows and MDC and Smegma and 20 Foot Man. And here in recent times, I'm getting to play with one of my heroes from Theater of Sheep, Jimmy Haskett. And so it's all good, baby.
And I would like to say, as Spider Moccasin had encouraged me to do, I forgot to mention that the opening song we heard a snippet of was from his new release, and it was called Summer Thunder. And we'll be hearing them play live in just a little bit, give us a taste of what people are going to hear at this event tomorrow. So before we talk about this event, Willamette Falls, Where the Future Began, where there's going to be craft exhibits, there's going to be music, there's going to be stuff for kids, there's going to be a whole bunch of stuff, and Roxandra will tell us all about that. But I first wanted to go back to David Lewis, and, you know, Willamette Falls, of course, is in Oregon City, which is south upriver of Portland, and has a really deep history that, you know, a lot of people who are more recently come to Portland probably don't have much an idea of, maybe even longtime Portlanders, or maybe people listening to us in other places other than Portland don't know all that much about. It's got a very deep history, both in terms of the indigenous inhabitants who are now included in the mostly in the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, and the more recent. It's got a major history in terms of the commercial and industrial development of this region, and we'll talk all about that. David, maybe you could talk about the importance of Willamette Falls historically, especially.
Yeah, Willamette Falls was a major village site where the Clackamas and Multnomah peoples on either side of the river lived there and basically controlled the trade there, they lived basically between Willamette Falls or just south of Willamette Falls all the way up to, they had villages all the way up into the Columbia area, across the Columbia into southern Washington area. And so they controlled a vast expanse of area. And so basically their resource there was the salmon and the eel, or the lamprey. We call it eel. It's not really an eel, but we call it eel. And they fished for those fishes, and would dry them, and then they would have a lot of fish there, a lot of dried fish, and so other tribes from the area would come there and want to trade for the salmon. And so they would bring the things they would make. Malalas would maybe bring elkskin armor or berries from the mountains, and Kalapuyas from the southern valley would bring camas or wapato up there to trade for salmon. And other people would come from the coast and down the Columbia, down the Willamette, and they would trade with, you know, abalone or dentalium or something else for, you know, whale parts or whale, even whale meat for salmon. And so it was one of the major hubs in the area that
we're losing you a little bit, David. The connection has gone a little muffled.
Sorry.
Oh, there you go.
So it was one of the major hubs in the area for all the tribes to trade there. And it was a pretty major resource, and has been a major resource throughout time through the colonization history and through the last 150, 160 years of Oregon history. And it's been recognized as probably the most significant site in Western Oregon because of the fact that there's this combination of natural resources, the possibility of using it for hydropower, or, you know, earlier were mill races, and then hydropower later on, and the possibility of transport from basically the agricultural center of the valley all the way, you know, basically on the river all the way to the ocean and out to international ports. So it's a pretty major resource for both Indian people and non-Indian people there, for the salmon, for its potential for power, and as a processing center for all the goods coming in from the valley and going out to ports abroad. So it's a pretty major place for us. You know, we value it for our annual gatherings there. We go and we study the salmon, and we gather eel there, and we do annual fish ceremonies there that honor not just fish and the falls and the resource that basically are gifting this stuff, these resources to us, but all our, you know, thousands of generations of people who live there for since time immemorial, or even some people say archaeologically that was at least 14,000 years ago we lived there. So it's pretty major. Tribes that came there to visit would have to meet with the local leaders, the chiefs and headmen, and they would have to be respectful there. They could fish there, and that was fine, as long as they were respectful, gave gifts, and pronounced their, you know, peaceful intentions in the area. And that was a pretty common practice all along the Columbia and throughout the native areas in Oregon.
Well, you know, it seems like just people all over the world seems pretty much always, I don't know, certainly now still, had a fascination with waterfalls, especially powerful waterfalls. Obviously, Celilo has been flooded for a long time, which was a great tragedy and impact on the native cultures of the Columbia River. It's kind of been somewhat easy to sort of just pass by Willamette Falls, partly because, you know, the industrial development alongside it kind of hid it to some extent from view. Of course, the, you know, mostly non-native sports fishermen have been using the below the falls fishing there, so they get to know it pretty well, boaters,
right?
And which is another story. But you know, the obviously waterfalls for fishing peoples in the Northwest have an added importance. People may not really know exactly why waterfalls are so important in native fisheries. Just maybe you could briefly explain that.
Well, the waterfall is a barrier, essentially. It's for the anadromous or the fish that seasonally migrate from, you know, inland to the ocean, and from the ocean back inland to spawn. It's a place where they have to stop and get ready, gather energy so they could jump over the falls to the next level, into the valley. And so that's the place for most falls, except for, you know, maybe Niagara, which is kind of impossible to jump, but for most of the smaller falls, I mean, the salmon can jump, especially at times of the year when there's lots of water. So that period of time when they're gathering energy, they're basically collecting it in the basin down there, And when they're jumping, they are momentarily vulnerable to being caught by people with nets or by fishermen or what have you.
Or bears.
Or, just all kinds of things. That's why the bears hang out there, or that's why the people hang out there. And so so any people would build scaffolds, and they would get out in their canoes, and they would wait for those salmon to jump. And then when they jumped, they would snag them with a net. It was a pretty easy way to catch salmon. It's not easy. The practice isn't easy, but it was easier than maybe just fishing with a line and a hook.
The Pacific Northwest male puts a lot of energy towards studying the snag.
Yeah.
So, thank you for that, Spider. Appreciate that. And so before we go on to Roxanne and then a musical interlude here coming up in a few minutes, David, do you have an idea of like when around the last period that the indigenous people were using in the way that you're describing Willamette Falls?
As late as last year.
Well, okay, before... I deserve that. I set myself up for that. That's fair enough. Okay. Okay, I want to have you talk about, I was actually going to ask you about when you said that you can return every year, and I was going to ask, you know, what is about that? But I guess I mean in terms of like, and not to diminish, you know, the current usages in any way in like some sort of comparison with the past. Those are unnecessary things, but in terms of like the before like the massive dislocation in terms of like village life and the trading center, like really full usage of the falls, is that known?
You know, the tribes of that area, the Clackamas, Multnomah, they signed the Willamette Valley Treaty in 1855, and you know, in 1856 they were moved to Grand Ronde, but In the interim, they were living on what we call a temporary reservation in the valley, and there was one established basically at the ferry site there. There used to be a ferry there in Oregon City, and as late as 1854, I believe, or 53, there was still a longhouse there on the West Lynn side of the river, where now PG&E is. So we actually have a painting that may depict that longhouse. It's from John McStanley. And that longhouse was burned by pioneers and settlers that were coming in. They apparently didn't like the Indians, and they wanted to get rid of them, so they burned the longhouse. But the Indians there were living there. They had the longhouse. They had other establishments for their laborers. They had drying racks for salmon. They had scaffolds. And so they were still using that area as the main fishing spot and the main living spot up into the mid 1850s, and then afterwards, even after they moved to Grand Ronde, there's something of a record of them going back to the falls every year and fishing there. They would ask the agent for a pass to leave the reservation, and then they would go back and they would fish there every year, and so that was pretty common. So in terms of habitation, basically mid-1850s, and then thereafter they were still kind of using the falls on an annual basis, mm-hmm. you know, when they traveled into the valley.
And something that, as you said, still continues, and we can talk about that. But first I'd like to just have Roxandra talk a little bit about this event that you've helped organize tomorrow, and where, when, what's happening.
Okay, great. So Oregon City and the Museum of the Oregon Territory are located 14 miles south of the KBOO studio. You drive down 99, cling to the river's, east side, and basically take McLaughlin Boulevard down, and you're there. The building overlooks Willamette Falls. It's directly across from the West Lynn paper mill on the other side, and the ruins of the Blue Heron paper mill on the east side of the river. At 11:30 a.m., author and historian Sandy Carter is going to read oral histories of former paper mill workers in the new mills gallery. At 12 noon, Spider Moccasin will be singing modern folk music for everyone, for the people.
For children of all ages.
Yes. And as always, folk music has touched on the modern issues of the day, and this is no exception. At 1 p.m., members of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde are going to bless us with their presence, a blessing song, a cultural address, and dedication of the art piece that they've contributed to the event and to the museum, which is a set of benches carved with traditional salmon drawings. The purpose of those benches is to sit and observe a 20-minute film that has been created by Portland General Electric to describe the falls in sort of a timeless way, starting with 14,000 years ago and tracing its industrial process and then the gradual dismantling of that industrial domination that has caused so many blocks of what was the first city in Oregon to be completely cut off from public use for 150 years. You've got cobblestone streets down there in the mills of the paper, the Blue Heron paper mill. You've got air plants growing on the side of ruins that are beautiful. And that is all going to be eventually made part of public access so that people of every nation can appreciate the wonder of the falls, the second largest waterfall in the country by volume. And as far as the Portland area is concerned, the most probably holy and thunderous spot that you could ever stand in, whether it's from above or from below, which I had the chance to do, stand barefoot on the rocks after kayaking up and saying, this is a holy place. I need to come back here. And more people need to know about this. Just physically, scientifically, it's invigorating. Spiritually, I can only
imagine. Negative ions, I hear.
Right. And I can only imagine what it would be like for people whose biological, genetic history, family culture goes back that far. At 2 p.m., the Westland Paper Company is going to talk about their history and sustainability. Things are not what they used to be in that water, is in terms of sulfur dioxides and toxins, and they're going in the right direction. And at 3 p.m., if you want to learn about papermaking and get your hands wet and figure out what modern papermaking is about, you can do that with a free workshop from Pulp and Decker Paper Company. And salmon is the focus of this. If kids want to bring an offering for salmon, for the sustainability of salmon, they can do that. We're at a trade site that's been key to this area for thousands of years. If you want to bring an item for trade, you're welcome to do that. There'll be a mural unveiled by the artist, comic book artist Alex Schomburg. You can read more about that online, and it happens to be about fishes of the Clackamas and other Oregon rivers. And the entire event is free. Thank you to the people that all participated in one way or another. It's a big giveaway and a big chance to celebrate what is Wakan, what is sacred about the Willamette River and the Willamette Falls.
Yeah, I've been noticing that there's a number of large projects that have been in the works for a while to really re-envision that whole area. I guess that this Oregon City itself has been devoting it to. But we can talk about all that. But I just want to remind people, you are listening to KBOO Radio. That's KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM here in the city. And we're also going out to Flume with the Corvallis, the Mid-Willamette Valley, and out into the Columbia River Gorge, Hood River, and other places there. And thank you all for joining us out there. And we do have some musicians in the studio who you heard are going to be tomorrow at this event where the feature began. So why don't you guys hit it? Why don't you want to tell us what we're going to hear?
We're going to do a song about the Oregon rivers.
River, empty shoes. River blues, I got them. Metolius, river Metolius. River blues, I got them. Oregon river blues.
So Spider, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about this new production you and Jimmy. I guess Jimmy you produced this at your Haskatron Studios?
Haskatron Studios, yes.
Yeah.
Well, we've been reconfiguring. You know, the Spider Moccasin Ensemble has undergone a lot of change in the past couple of years. I'm afraid that we lost a series of very important people in our lives, boom, 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 all in a row. The passing of John Talley, the longtime DJ, programming host of Community Radio KBOO's Indian World Show, was a tremendous life-altering experience for me and all of the musicians that I brought here to the radio station to play on his program. He generously provided an opportunity for us from 1997 through 2003 to appear on his program again and again and again. And then within a few weeks of losing old dear John, my bass player for 20 years, Bob Roque, he died. And that was a staggering tragedy for my family. He was my mom's boyfriend. He was my roommate. He played bass with the Spider Moccasin Ensemble for basically 19 years in a row. And so those were huge changes in my life. And I ended up cocooning and woodshedding for a year. I got off stage. And when I came out of my grief, I found Jimmy Haskett there waiting for me with Tommy Hollywood, Tom Hood, the longtime station engineer for Community Radio KBOO. And they basically helped me build a new batch of wilderness and Western murder ballads that we've been playing out. And Roxandra Pennington happened to come to our performance last August. Yes. At Slabtown, which was standing room only. We appeared with Eric Lee on drums, and Tom Hood ripping on lead guitar. And so from that point forward, we've been recording and fulfilling small gig obligations, and we're really looking forward to tomorrow at Roxandra's event at the Museum of the Oregon Territories. Please come out and join us for that. We go on at noon, but things really get kickstarted around 11 a.m.
Well, maybe you could hear a little bit more later, perhaps another song. I would, David, are you still with us?
I am.
Sorry, I guess I didn't necessarily let you know exactly what the format of this. It kind of all came together at the last minute in any case. So I appreciate your patience in being here through all this. And so I mentioned that you were the author of this book, The Termination of the Grand Ron, which is a very large subject. And a difficult subject. I think people in Oregon still haven't really confronted that history. I think you would probably agree with that. So that's something that happened in the 1950s. So there's this long history of people continuing, as you said, which is really interesting. It must have been really an interesting experience living at different times, and like seeing Native people go back to the falls. Must have been all kinds of encounters, you know, just a rich history there, probably some not so great encounters, I imagine, who knows. But bring us a little bit up to date. I know that the Grand Ron has really put mighty efforts into coming back together again after that, the period of termination, and it's just a rich history continually being written as we speak. But if you would, just since you're, you know, also because you're a scholar in this, maybe just talk a little bit about what led up to the termination and how that has sort of played into all this story that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing history. And I was, you know, being a scholar and being a researcher at the University of Oregon, I was surprised to actually come upon it, because I hadn't really thought that history hadn't been written yet. And so what I started to do was, you know, listen to my elders, and they were saying, you know, we didn't agree to termination. And I began asking the question, and I said, well, did we agree or didn't we agree? You know, what is the real story? And so I began looking at termination as my terminal project for my dissertation, and I began realizing that nobody really had really studied it before. And so I found that in the 1940s, Congress, the U.S. Congress, was really concerned about money, because they had, you know, fought a big war, World War II, and tribes and the Bureau of Indian Affairs were essentially a whole $40 million overhead for them that they wanted to get rid of, because they had already, you know, grown the War Department by 2,000%. For World War II, so they wanted to find any way they could to save money. So by 1947, they began to hold budgetary hearings in the House, and they found out that that if they did any kind of investment in reservations, they wouldn't get a return on investment, because the land is non-taxable. So what they decided to do is terminate. The original plan was to terminate all reservations in the United States, take all that land, sell it to the public, you know, develop the land, you know, mine the resources, you know, dam up all the rivers, you know, produce power,
and lumber.
Thereby, you know, yeah, lumber, you know, minerals, all that stuff, and thereby they hope to revive the U.S. economy and regional economies through lumber or through logging and stuff like that. And so that was the plan. I mean, back, you know, before World War II, they were actually making a plan to ship all of our power from the Northwest to Southern California, because California was a hugely growing economy at the time. And so they began putting in plans for, you know, damming up the Columbia, you know, damming up Celilo, damming up all the rivers in Oregon, and then shipping that power through the BPA all the way down to Southern California. And they began to implement that in the 50s, and the tribes were basically in the way because we had all the land. We had a bunch of land. You know, the Klamath tribe had the headwaters of the Klamath River, and so they had to get rid of a couple of major tribes so that they could do what they wanted to do for power and development of the West. So what I figured out, it was basically the last colonization of Indian country in the West. They hadn't fully succeeded with treaties and with reservations in the 1850s and 60s. So what they did is they basically did it through an argument that they created. They basically said, well, we have all these Indian problems in Indian country. There's a lot of people very poor. Some reservations are in fourth world conditions. No running water, no roads, no power, no anything. Not like average Americans. So the United States government agreed that we had created this problem. The BIA had impoverished tribes, and therefore we needed to free them from any further government oppression. So that argument they sold to the press and to politicians and to Indian people as the best way to go.
Whereas the reality was, I mean, the Klamath were an incredibly self-sufficient. They had really developed their own forest industries. A lot of the tribes had done that. Had really, you know, after all the difficulties, you know, in the warfare period, the colonization period, and post, and there's like each one has its own story about that, and being put on reservations, being dislocated. A lot of them had really successfully adapted to a new way of life.
Right, so tribes like the Osage, and who had lots of oil, and the Klamath, who had 1 million acres of ponderosa pine, were some of the richest people on the face of the earth. I mean, Klamaths were incredibly rich. They paid for all their expenses. And so when they approached the BIA in the 40s, about a change in the administration, what they wanted was they didn't want the BIA to be the middleman between the sale of their lumber and the market. What they wanted was the complete control of their own reservation because they had plenty of resources and plenty of money. And what it turned into later on, 10 years later, was termination. They lost all the land. They got a big payout, and then they were told they had to leave and move down somewhere to like Oakland or something like that. So they lost their culture. They lost their river, and for, you know, a few decades, they didn't have really a reservation until they were restored. So for Grand Ronde, it was a little bit different because we didn't have the amazing resources that they had. Well, we had a few hundred acres left of the original 60,000 acre reservation, and so what we got in payment was $35. So it was pretty dramatically different. And the reason why we were terminated, it wasn't because of our resources. We didn't have any resources. We were terminated because the governor of Oregon, Douglas McKinney, became the Secretary of Interior at that time. He wanted to make an example of Oregon tribes, and because we didn't have a lot of money or resources, we couldn't defend ourselves from termination. So he made an example of the Western Oregon tribes by terminating all of us, Tillets, Grand Ronde, people in Empire, all the fourth sector folks that were non-reservations, and at one time in one bill, Public Law 588.
Yeah, the Oregon was the hardest hit state by termination. So, and I know there's a even deeper history going back to the original treaties. There's various unratified treaties taking away the reservation to begin with. There's all kinds of, but nevertheless, Grand Ronde up till the 50s, there had been some kind of cohesion, still some kind of community cohesion that then got further impacted by termination.
Right, it was a gradual, disassociation from the land where, you know, in the 1840s, settlers came in and became a great migration from the east. They began to take land, even though it was illegal. There had been no treaties made with tribes, so the tribes still owned the land. There were treaties that began, they began to have treaties in the 1851. Those treaties all failed because the agent failed to remove the tribes from the land. They actually created temporary reservations, or actually permanent reservations within the valley, and places where settlers wanted to live. So because settlers didn't want to live amongst Indians, the treaties failed in Congress. sent Joel Palmer then to make treaties. He made 7 successful treaties in Western Oregon, and those treaties were ratified by Congress, and that removed all the tribes of Western Oregon to essentially 2 reservations, the first to Grand Ronde, and then later, and then maybe a year later to the Coast Indian Reservation, which became in 1875 the Select Reservation. So, I mean, and then in the 1890s, after the Dawes Act was passed and after they had surveyed the land, they allotted a lot of the land on the reservations to the tribes, and what was left over was called surplus, and they sold it to the public. So we went from an original 60,000-acre reservation from the down to about 35,000 acres of allotment. And then in the succeeding 40 or so years, many people got their fee simple title to the land and sold their land because they didn't have a lot of resources or money. And so they eventually all the land went away from the tribe, so that by 1950 we had about 600 acres left.
Well, this is a kind of a telescoped history here of a really long travail and interesting and also a tale of tenacity and survival as well. And obviously you're still there, and you're bringing back a lot of your traditions. You're continuing to go to Willamette Falls, as you said earlier, and you're going to be participating in this event tomorrow. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, so tomorrow I'll be talking, there'll be some drum songs and some ceremony. We'll have council members there, and I'll be talking about some of the tribal history, history of the falls, history of the tribe, and they will be honoring and blessing the carvings that are being donated to the museum, and it should be a pretty good event. We like to help people understand our history, because most people in Oregon don't really understand our history at all, and in fact, up to maybe 10 years ago, most people thought that we didn't exist anymore, so...
Yeah, I was lucky enough to participate in painting a historical mural for the Grand Ronde tribe that's 60 feet long and 20 feet tall that Mr. Carl Abramovic created the composition for. And I'm Spider Moccasin, and I got to paint on that project along with the Portland area Indian artist Toma Villa and also Leo Wayman. The four of us went in for several weeks and made this enormous historical mural. So I've seen firsthand.
Where is that?
The generosity of the Grand Ronde people. They mounted this piece outdoors on the outside corner of the area that leads into some of their elderly housing.
Well, it's down in Grand Ronde.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not at the casino. It's a totally separate program. But I've seen how proactive their education and their community outreach is, and it's something to admire.
And the young people that are leading that movement are just the most honorable, well-spoken, brilliant, and generous people that I've met in a long time, and that's what it takes to build a new world, I think. That's the kind of foundation you've got to have. And it's exciting to see that they're willing to work with a small museum like ours on land that traditionally has been the site of great social injustice. And I think that of the things that David said, that the thing that hit me the most was just talking about disassociation from the land. And this event doesn't attempt to solve the problems that the salmon face, that the lamprey face, that the people face, that are trying to reassociate with the land. It doesn't solve the problems of water, wildlife, or cultural perfection. It's just a way of getting everyone, the key people, together to say, what are we going to do now? Because we all basically want what's best, and we need to communicate, and it's just symbolic of that. The museum that the Grand Ronde is building of their own is something that we hope at the Museum of the Oregon Territory to contribute to in the in terms of deaccessioning certain artifacts that we have there that were given or traded or purchased from the early Native Americans of the area by certain collectors that lived in the Oregon City area, and really belong to the people and should be properly interpreted and studied and redistributed and seen. And that's one of our wing really has a great collection, and I hope that people will come out tomorrow and really appreciate that. from the story it tells about trade, because every bead, every pipe there, every implement that was there was traded for something, and it all goes back to the resources that were already being utilized and managed in very successful ways by the Confederated Tribes and other tribes that were part of the Salmon Nations.
I neglected to reintroduce our guest. That was Roxandra Pennington, again, the event coordinator at the Oregon, the Museum of the Oregon Territories. And earlier you heard a Spider Moccasin, a Warm Springs tribal member and longtime area musician, with his musical partner, Jimmy Haskett, again, also a longtime Portland musician, formerly with Theater of Sheep. And we have online David Lewis, who has many roles with the Grand Ronde Tribe, including a museum curator, tribal historian, cultural liaison, and fairly recently elected chairman of the Oregon Heritage Commission. David, would you like to, before we hear a final song from our duo here, would you like to talk about this appointment to the Oregon Heritage Commission? That seems, I don't know, have any other Native Americans been appointed to that commission before?
Yeah, I'm in my second term on the commission, so uh-huh. The first term was four years, and so I basically just come on to see what it was all about, and it became a really important endeavor for Oregon for me, and I began to understand a little more completely all the different heritage work going on in Oregon. Early on, we addressed some serious issues in Oregon because of the decline in the economy. Many heritage institutions throughout the state were closing. And in fact, I think the Museum of the Oregon Territory closed for a while, and the museum at the end of the Oregon Trail closed, and museums in the South, like, you know, Southern Oregon Historical Society closed, and just recently the Jensen Art Museum has closed. So we have a very serious problem in the state with heritage institutions basically going under because the model for funding them has not came through complete. So we're working on solutions for that. And so I've tried to help with that effort, tried to offer my perspectives from my education, from my tribe, on how to make, you know, how to go forward with it. And I think that caught the attention of some of the folks on the commission, so they all agreed that I should become the chair this last year. And I hope to take that movement and try and help all of Oregon Heritage, you know, survive and move into a more prosperous period is something I take up in my term as my 2-year term as a chair. So we have other Native people on the commission. The commission began in the 1990s, so it's not a long-term mm-hmm. organization for Oregon yet, but it has been around for about almost 20 years. And so we had a member on there, Don Ivey, and he's from the Coquel Indian Tribe. He became vice chair before I came on the commission, and he went off and I came on. And I know him very well. We're great friends, and I believe he's taking an appointment at University of Oregon in some respect. But he was the cultural director at the Coquel Tribe for many years. And so I'm kind of honored to be in that same class as him, because I see him as kind of a model for how people should treat other people in Oregon.
Well, with that, let's go to one more song, and then we'll do a wrap-up before ending this program. And this is KBOO Portland. My name is Paul Rowland, hosting this special public affairs program, talking about the Willamette Falls, past, present, and future. Big day event tomorrow in Oregon City, celebrating Willamette Falls and its history. Spider.
Hey, I'm Spider Moccasin. I'm about to perform this next bit with Jimmy Haskett. We're going to do a song by our drummer, Eric Lee. Eric Lee is a fantastic writer. He was the first journalist to publish a story about the late Elliot Smith. And our writer-drummer friend, Eric, composed this song about natural resource management. It's called Dead Man's Town.
Let's on the outskirts of town. Take a dirty drink from a hole in the ground. Eat a pan of beans while the sun goes down and the sawmill is burning away. In the morning we'll decide if we're western bound, move it along or put a claim down. Do a little mining in a dirty little town and the sawmill is burning away. We will poison the water, poison the ground, use it all up or burn the rest down. There's another train going to another little town and the sawmill is burning away. Oh, burn it away, yeah.
The last out of those notes. I like that, yeah.
And he keeps saying everything that I forgot to say.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Spider. Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate your being here.
All right. My pleasure.
So we've got just a few more minutes. Maybe, Roxandra, you could just refresh our memories about this event tomorrow.
Alrighty, thank you. Tomorrow from 11 to 4 in Oregon City, south of the Portland metro area. At 211 Tumwater Drive, overlooking Willamette Falls, we have the event called Willamette Falls, Where the Future Began, which is an intercultural, inter-heritage event with music, art, new exhibits, a chance for people to learn the story of where it is we live. The Chinook-speaking tribes, I believe the Clackamas, called the Willamette Falls Tumwata, which is kind of like a reference to both tum-tum, the heartbeat of the land, and another interpretation of that word was Big Chief Waterfall. So I just want to invite all authentic human beings, all river people, and all people that want to save salmon, which are endangered, wild salmon are endangered, and all people who want a healthy river that our children can swim in the future, to come out and enjoy this free event. You can learn more at clackamashistory.org or by Googling the Museum of the Oregon Territory. And things start up at 11, and Spider Moccasin is going to be playing at noon, and David Lewis and elders from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde are going to be speaking at 1 p.m.
Thank you, Roxandra.
Thank you, Paul.
Event coordinator with the Museum of the Oregon Territories. David, last word to you. We just got a couple. I guess I'd like you to also, if there's any like online resources or books or anything that you might refer to people, and again, just let you know, tell people why Willamette Falls matters in our lives today.
Yeah. So, if people want to do further research on tribal history, most of the tribes have websites that have history written onto the websites in sort of their heritage area. And so I encourage people to look at that, because that history is really written by Native people and really needs to be looked at and understood by people in Oregon. You mentioned my dissertation earlier, and that's actually available online. It's at the University of Oregon Scholars Bank. And if you look up the Scholars Bank, it's an online resource where if you go to there, then you can do a search for my name, David Lewis, or Termination of Grand Ronde, and you'll come up with the PDF of the full dissertation, so you can read the whole thing yourself. So it's a good resource. There are lots of other resources online. I don't know if I can spiel them out right now,
Maybe you could we could exchange emails. I could link to them perhaps. So when I
sure yeah
okay
yeah. So the you know the falls is a pretty amazing resource for us, and we really honor it. And I think in some regards it's kind of a return for us, for us to be welcomed back by the counties and the cities to come there and do programming and to work with the communities for heritage and for the health of the falls, the health of the fish. And I think that's a really amazing process in itself. And I think I feel very welcomed in the area, very welcomed by the museums and all the heritage societies there. And I'm thankful to be around today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, David Lewis, and our other guests today. This has been really interesting experiment in radio, live radio. Always interesting here on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name's Paul Rowland. This is Public Affairs Programming. Thanks, Spider.
Great work, Paul.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Thank you, Jimmy.
Yeah, thank you.
And Roxandra and David. And stay tuned for more excellent programming here on your community radio station. Thanks a lot for listening. Bye-bye now.
Friday, January 31st from 8 to 10 p.m. to celebrate the completion of the 2013 Artists in Residence program. Our 2013 artist, Marisa Anderson, will perform live as well as play the record she recorded during the residency in its entirety. She'll also guest DJ and we'll talk about the Artists in Residence experience. That's Marisa Anderson, live, Friday, January 31st from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Do you want to get more involved with KBOO? This is your time. Come on into KBOO for our winter membership drive. The drive happens February 6th through February 15th. There are shifts available 7 days a week, generally spanning the hours of 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., so there are shifts to fit anyone's schedule. KBOO depends on our listeners to keep us on the air, and the drives are a huge part of that. They are what allows KBOO to be so independent and unique. We have more than 400 shifts to fill, so your participation will be very much appreciated. The drive is a great way to meet other volunteers and get a good feel for what it's like to volunteer at your community radio station. Interested? Contact Ani for more information or to schedule your help. Her email address is volunteer@kboo.org, or you can phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10:02. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, January 31st, 2014, And you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. First, a few headlines. We're going to take speaking later in the program with Ivan Malesky with a family farm group that is fighting tooth and nail to protect the farmers that produce the real food. Real food, not the orange food that comes in crinkly packets. Protect these people from the farm bill, which has managed to underwrite the poisoning of America whenever it raises its head. The farm bill hasn't raised its head in 5 years, so the fact that we have one at all is of passing interest to farmers large and small across the country. He'll be speaking with us on that subject. Headlines first, though. The NATO 3, that's Brian Jacob Church, Brent Medley, and Joanne Chase, each face terrorism and other felony conspiracy charges. They are the three, the NATO 3, recall, who came up from Florida to Chicago for protests. And their trio, was joined by a mole and an informant who set them up, basically, encouraged them to do all manner of felonious things which might not have occurred to them, being peace lovers all. And now, of course, the NATO 3, that's Church, Bentley,